You know, we live in a day and age where science is the epistemic king. In other words, you can get into any discussion on just about any topic, and all someone has to do is say, well, the science proves this, or the science says that, and supposedly educated, sophisticated people in the know, well, that should automatically end the discussion because science says it. Well, you know, it's not quite as simple as that, and that's something, a theme I'd like to explore as we get into today's program. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here, and welcome to the show. You know, Dr. Brian Greene is a physicist, one who has specialized in an area called string theory. And string theory is one of the latest attempts to get at what has been called a theory of everything. That is, what is the universe's most basic and ultimate matter? I mean, if you were to break everything down to the ultimate constituent parts, what would that part be? Now, of course, that question itself is somewhat heavily loaded in a lot of ways. It's very theory-laden in a lot of ways, and I just want to look at one. The question of, why does it have to be composed of just one single thing? That seems to be a presupposition based on, well, I don't know what. Maybe there's a good reason for this, but there's this idea that if you just keep peeling back the onion, you will get to the ultimate building block from which all else is built from. But again, I ask, why just one? Why not two? Why not 50? I don't know. You know, there's this idea, it's called Occam's razor, which you might have heard about and which it's often called. But what makes Occam's razor so sacrosanct? What has given Occam's razor, and I don't even think that's a phrase he used, the status of being the ultimate kind of arbiter of how we understand our theories? But I don't want to get into that. That's another matter. That's another show, perhaps. Anyway, Brian Greene, as I said, is a string theorist, and he is looking for that ultimate constituent, that ultimate thing, working on the assumption that it exists. Now, Brian Greene is also a very prolific and very popular writer, author of books like The Elegant Universe and The Fabric of the Cosmos, and his latest, The Hidden Reality, Parallel Universes and the Deep Law of the Cosmos. Now, in Hidden Reality, he tells an interesting story about his first year at college when he took a philosophy course from the late Robert Nozick, a philosopher of some fame, at least those who are into philosophy. Now, in the course, Nozick brings up questions that I have played around with on the show for years now, and that is, how do we know what is really out there? What is out there compared to how we perceive it? How closely do our concepts of what's out there correspond to really what's out there? Can we ever know? Does this idea of what's really out there mean? How can we know much of anything that's out there anyway? But anyway, in this book, The Hidden Reality, Greene told how he's hanging around after class and with his teacher, and Nozick asked him what he was interested in. Well, Brian Greene brazenly said that he wanted to work on quantum gravity and unified field theories. And then Nozick then asked him, he said, what drives your interest? And Greene said that he wanted to, quote, find eternal truths to help understand why things are the way that they are. A rather ambitious young man for sure. Then Nozick then asked him, he said to him, let's say you find the unified theory. Would that really provide the answers you're looking for? Wouldn't you still be left asking why that particular theory and not another is the correct one and not another as the correct theory of the universe? Hey, folks, I once did a whole program asking the same question. I guess I'm in good company. Anyway, back to the story. Green said that, yeah, you're right. He said that he's right and that you might have to come to a point where, and let me quote Green, where he says, we would have to accept certain things as a given. Oh, really now? Take them as a given? Meaning what? What's the word I'm looking for? What is that word? Take them as a given. Oh, yes. Faith. Faith. Now, we're not talking religion here, are we? We're talking science. But anyway, I digress. I want to get back to the story. And this is where it gets very interesting and insightful, too, about how the postmodern mind works, about how sheer speculation can sometimes get to the status of knowledge. Now, according to Green, Nozick wanted to, quote, defang the question. That is, well, let me quote Green himself. According to him, Nozick's view was as follows. Now, listen to this. Listen to this, quote, explanation. If you want to avoid explaining why one particular theory should be singled out over another, then don't single it out. Nozick suggests that we imagine we're part of a multiverse that comprises every possible universe. The multiverse would include not only the alternative evolutions emerging from the quantum multiverse, or the many bubble universes of the inflationary universe, or the possible stringy worlds of the brain or landscape universes. These universes wouldn't, on their own, fulfill Nozick's proposal, because you'd still be left wondering, why quantum mechanics? Or why inflation? Or why it's string theory? Instead, come up with any possible universe whatsoever. It could be made out of the usual atomic species, but a universe made solely of melted mozzarella would serve just as well, and it has a place in Nozick's scheme. A universe made of mozzarella? Okay, so Nozick is a philosopher, not a scientist. Fine. But postulating on a universe made out of mozzarella is, well, fine, he's a philosopher. What kind of philosophy is that? You see, Nozick's idea is basically is, don't worry about seeking an explanation of why the universe is one way or another. You can't do that, because if you do that, you're stuck with the logical question of why is the universe this way and not that way. And whatever explanation you give will itself need an explanation, and on and on and on, an infinite regress, which leads to nowhere, to no explanation at all. So what do you do? So you postulate an infinite number of universes with every possible explanation imaginable, and voila, you solve the problem of having to assume anything by faith, because you have every possible universe imaginable. Now, you know, I don't know, but there's something wrong with here on a lot of levels. As I've said on this program before, the concept of an infinite number of universes only makes the question of their origin infinitely more complex than the idea of the existence of one universe. And a universe made out of mozzarella cheese? Okay, fine. But where did it come from? And why mozzarella cheese and not Swiss cheese or something exotic like Tommy Creuse cheese from France? Plus two, where is the science that shows that there are these infinite number of universes out there? That's what Green's book was all about, the, quote, scientific basis for the idea of multiple universes. Now, please, I won't even feign to try to challenge Dr. Green's area of expertise. I'm not going to do that. But at the same time, I couldn't help, as I read this book, just wonder where the line between science and philosophical speculation has been crossed. And it's not always easy to tell. And there seemed to be an awful lot of the latter involved in this book. Now, this is no real fault of Dr. Green. In this book, whether he realized it or not, he was giving us an example of what has been called in the history of science, or more specifically in the philosophy of science, the demarcation problem, which is the title of this program. What is the demarcation problem? Well, very simply, it boils down to the question of what is science? You say, what is science? Well, everybody knows what science is, right? I mean, science is, well, it's science, you know, physics, chemistry, biology, geology, you know, that kind of stuff, right? Well, yeah, but just listing a bunch of things that come under the heading of science does not explain to us what science is. Rather, what we want to ask is, what are the common features that they all have, which allows them to be under the rubric of science? Now, folks, this gets a little more tricky. The demarcation between science and other forms of knowledge, which is precisely why it's called the demarcation problem. Well, then, let's ask the question another way. What is the difference between what we would call science, real science, as opposed to pseudoscience? Or even what many would term not science at all. After all, not everything that is out there that is called science is necessarily good science. Or maybe it's not true science at all, but maybe it's philosophy masquerading as science, using some of the terminology, lingos, and even methods of science. See, my point here is this. It's called the demarcation problem because it is a problem. And the problem is giving an accurate and universal definition of what science, or what someone wants to call true science, really is. And it's a problem because, surprisingly enough, there really isn't a whole lot of agreement even on the definition of what science is itself, much less what constitutes good science as opposed to pseudoscience, or what is scientific at all. You know, it's amazing, really, just how involved and complicated this whole thing is. Because just when you think you have a good definition of science, someone will come up with an example that would, for instance, exclude chemistry because it doesn't fit the model. Or they would come up with an example that you could would force you to include something like astrology. You know, I mean, for instance, science is a way of looking at the world that makes predictions about what happens in the future, right? Okay, isn't that what science does? Well, doesn't astrology do the same thing? Yeah, to a certain degree it does. And yet, who really wants to call astrology science? Or sometimes we hear about the science of economics. Is economics a science? Well, I don't know. It depends on a bunch of philosophical presuppositions. And here, let me whisper to you a little secret that a lot of the scientific elite and cognoscenti don't want you to know, which is you really can't do science without doing philosophy. And hey, we all know how wacky philosophy can be. So again, is economics a science? It does make predictions. It does involve a lot of computation and math. It does involve a lot of theories. Sounds like a science to me. And yet, no doubt many people would question its epistemic status as science. Now, the reason I bring this up is because, as I've said before on this show, ideas have consequences. And though however much we are told that we live in the postmodern era and on and on and on, our day-to-day life is really built on modernism. It's built on the scientific revolution. It's built on some of the principles that go back to the Enlightenment. Our lives, our culture, our way of life is a great degree built upon science, or more specifically, I should say, on the technology that science has spawned. I mean, come on. When you log on to your computer in the morning or whenever, do you start asking postmodernist questions about regimes of truth, or cultural relativism, or deconstruction, or le différence, or meta-narratives, or legitimization, or language games? Of course not. You turn it on and you expect the technology and the science behind it to work the same today as it did yesterday. You're expecting reality to function according to the technology built on science, just as when you use your cell phone, when you get a CAT scan, or when you get in an airplane. In other words, in the most mundane tasks, we in the West are especially modernists whose lives are built around the presupposition of science. And this gets important, I think, especially important, when worldviews presented by science clashes, as they often do with other worldviews, such as the worldviews presented by faith. And so important, so often, many people are so willing to concede, to capitulate to science because, well, look at all that science has done for us. We can't ignore it, can we? No. I'm not saying to ignore it, but we need to understand that the findings of science are nowhere near as objective and as solid as universe as we often like to think they are, or as that they are often presented to us as being. And one of the first places where we can see the limitations is in what is called the demarcation problem, which again asks the basic questions. Okay, what is science in contrast to pseudoscience, or to philosophy, or to any other form of knowledge that claims some sort of epistemic status? How do we differentiate between science and other forms of knowledge? How do we differentiate between science and pseudoscience when anyone has studied this knows that at times science, or what has been deemed science, has made false predictions, while what is deemed pseudoscience has made correct ones? As I said already, and I've talked about on other shows, just because something makes an accurate prediction doesn't make it right, doesn't make it scientific. Many false theories have made accurate predictions. After all, how did it ever get to be deemed a theory in the first place if it didn't get it right at least a few times? And besides, most scientific theories today have anomalies, things that don't fit into the theory. Anomalies, they call them. As I've said here before, two of the most successful scientific theories, quantum theory and general relativity, contradict each other. Something's wrong somewhere, they don't know where. Anyway, it's not so easy as one might think. I mean, in the 1969, the Parapsychological Association was admitted into the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Is the study of ESP really science, or is it pseudoscience, or is it even science at all? In college, I knew a guy who was having occult experiences, and he was being studied in the lab, and they connected wires and all this stuff to his head. Is this science? Well, it sure sounds like it, yet I wonder how well it might fit some of the definitions that are used to demarcate science. And what about string theory, one of the, quote, hardest sciences of all? Problem is, there's not much experimental evidence to back it up. Lots of fancy and beautiful math, which is fine. But shouldn't something deemed science have some sort of experimental or, you know, empirical observations to back it up? But I don't think there's much of that at all with string theory. Is it science then? And yet who certainly wants to equate astrology with science, even though it's got some very verifiable observations? Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. To say that something is not science is not to make it wrong or bad or the like. I mean, is after all mathematics science? Not sure it could be called that, at least by some definitions. And yet, who's going to say math in and of itself is bad or wrong? Some would argue, indeed, that math has a higher epistemic status than most of the hardest sciences. Now, one of the most earliest and influential philosophers of science, a man named Karl Popper, he really wanted to know what was the difference between what Albert Einstein accomplished with relativity theory and what Sigmund Freud did with psychoanalysis and what Karl Marx did with his class theories and about economics and so often, so forth. For starters, many call them all science. I mean, after all make some fairly accurate predictions. All could, to some degrees, be made to fit with observations. I mean, after all, isn't that so much of what scientific proof is about? You come up with a theory that explains X, why X does Y, and sure enough, X does Y. Thus, your theory is right, or at least it hasn't been proved wrong. And here is where Popper came in with his very novel ideas. For starters, he was very skeptical about observational evidence as any kind of confirmation of a theory. Now, I know that sounds strange, but as Popper saw it, observation doesn't really mean all that much. It's simply interpreting things in light of the theory you already have. It's a priori theory dependent. According to him, for instance, the Marxists could claim, you know, could find a way to make anything fit in their theory. The same with Freud and all his work. All could claim observations that fit their theory. But again, astrology makes accurate predictions too. In fact, it was precisely because they claimed many observational successes that he became skeptical. Anything that happened, Marxists could fit it into their theory, or so Popper claimed. The same with Freud. If someone tried to explain a drowning child by, you know, someone who drowns a child by throwing him into a river, and someone else comes along and risks his life to save the child, Freudians could use their theory to explain both behaviors. Thus, Popper came up with what he called falsibility or falsification. And this is very interesting, and it sounds a little funky, but it's very, very interesting. Something can be labeled true science if it is falsifiable. That is, if you could prove it wrong. For Popper, Einstein's theory of gravitation, also known as general relativity, fit this because you could do experiments that could, quote, prove it wrong. That's what makes it science. Now, to say that something is science doesn't mean that the science is right. Something could be truly scientific and be wrong, as has often happened. The demarcation problem is really not dealing directly with what is a correct scientific theory. It's more fundamental than that. It's dealing with what is a scientific theory itself, as opposed to a pseudoscientific one. Something could be deemed science, bona fide science, and yet still be utterly wrong. Anyway, Popper's insight was deemed quite a breakthrough. Quite a breakthrough. Something is deemed science, not pseudoscience, if it could be falsified. Thus, the implications of what he taught are very interesting, because one could conclude from it that we really never know if a scientific theory is true. All we can do is prove it wrong. It can be falsifiable, that is, if it's science and not pseudoscience to begin with. If that sounds too simple, it is, because believe me, it's filled with loopholes. It was, and so much of the philosophy of science since then has been dealing with Popper. And any book you read on the philosophy of science today will inevitably start talking about Popper and so on. And then there are a lot of problems with Popper's theory, but I think the important thing is that it shows that it's just not so easy even to define what science is as we often think. It's, oh, well, science, it's obvious what it is. And again, but Popper's problem, let's go back to Popper for a minute and some of the problems here. For starters, creationists and evolutionists pretty don't do this all the time. Or that is, whatever either one finds, they manage to fit their theory one way or another to make it worth. Thus, by this criteria, neither evolution nor creationism is science. Now, that doesn't make either one wrong. It just makes them something other than science. And it's interesting, too, for what it's worth, for much of his career, Popper didn't even deem evolution as science. Though later on he waffled a bit. I think it might have had something to do with the fact that he was asked to give the first Darwinian lecture somewhere at Cambridge or somewhere. So suddenly in his mind, evolution now suddenly becomes a science. Now also, his argument ran into another problem. Newton's theory of gravity made an incorrect prediction about the movements of the planet Uranus. Rather than abandon the theory, because it made a false prediction, folks simply postulated that another planet out there had to exist, which turned out to be Neptune. Thus, these scientists did what Popper accused Marxists, because he never believed that Marxism was a science, or Freud. He accused them doing of, you know, they did with astronomy what he claimed the Marxists and so on were doing. But they turned out to be right. In other words, it turned out there really was another planet there, so the theory was saved anyway. Anyway, the point is, a host of other weaknesses have been brought up about the theory, about Popper's whole concept of the demarcation problem and falsification. And though it has many weaknesses, many still think there's something to it. As I said, you can't really pick up a book. You can't pick up a book on the philosophy of science, and they don't talk about Popper, and they don't talk about falsification, and so on. So there's something to it. But as I said, in any of the theories on the philosophy of science, whatever you run into, none of them work fully, because as I said before, they tend to, if you follow that theory, something that we would deem as science is thrown out, and something that we wouldn't deem as science is brought in. So again, what is the point of all this? Popper and his falsification and this whole question. And I think it's important because, as I've said before, however much we say, oh, we're in the postmodernists, we're postmodernists, or now we're post-postmodern, what the post-postmodernism is, we really do live with a modernist worldview, most of us. And this underpins pretty much of our existence. And it places so much, which this kind of belief places so much evidence on something just because it's science. And, you know, we really ought to be careful with that. We really ought to be very, very careful with that. When folks today can't even agree on just what science itself is, we're going to put all our eggs in one basket. Well, science says it, therefore we have to go with it. And really, just even agreeing on what science is, that itself is the easy part. It's really hard, gets hard determining whether the theories of something deemed as science are true or false. And there's no question we will deal with that more down the road. And I guess the point, as we wind this down, because the clock just gives me a little more time here, is we've got to be careful. And you remember, for those of you who watched the program, remember I did a show, Science Works. And there's an awful lot of scientific theories that worked. In other words, you can get from A to B or B to C, or you can do all sorts of stuff based on the science, based on a theory that was proven false. So even though we live in the scientific era, and even though science has done many great and marvelous things, we need to be careful about how much emphasis we put on science. As I said in the beginning, any discussion comes up, all someone has to say is, well, the science proves it, the science proves it, boom, 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 and the case is closed. The science proves it. How dare anybody, you know, go against what the science says? Well, there's been an awful lot of people all through history with a lot of egg on their face, because they did something just because it was science. Science is great, science is wonderful, science has its role, but let's not attribute it to a role greater than it deserves.